Think you're starting that podcast back there, buddy?
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. For the rest of our crew that's not here today, this morning's going to be a little different. Still in the series through the Old Testament, but a little different because of the context and the passages that we're talking about this morning. This is probably, at least for me, one of the hardest sermons in this series. It has some of the most challenging material. So we're going to do a little bit more teaching today probably than we normally would. This series so far has been very kind of narrative-driven, very story-driven. And today we're going to have some teaching that's more theological in some sense in order to make sense of what we're reading. So we're in the book of Joshua today. So if you want to head there, you're welcome to. We'll get to it in a minute. First, we're going to recap where we've been and how we've gotten to this point. And if you haven't been with us, we've been starting numerous mornings with some participation. So I need your help again this morning. I'm going to take us from the beginning up until the point where we are, but you need to fill in some of the blanks this morning. So just shout it out. If you think you know, if you want to take a stab at it, here we go. The story begins in the beginning with two people named... Okay, we got a participant here. Now, that's a great example. The rest of you are welcome to participate at that same level. Adam and Eve, yes. And then all sorts of stuff happens. None of it is very good. Cain and Abel, the generation of Noah and the wickedness of the earth. We get to the Tower of Babel. Again, more kind of arrogance shown by humanity. And then we get to a guy, anybody know by the name of? We will get to him. You ain't kidding. Yep. The guy after Babel is Abraham, right? Abraham. And God says to Abraham, I'm going to make a covenant with you that you will be blessed in order to be a blessing. Yeah. Blessed to be a blessing. God says, I'm going to, Genesis 15, I'm going to give you and your descendants a land, a place to have as your home, but it's going to take 400 years for you to get there. So your descendants are going to be as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the sea, but it will be 400 years, and a good chunk of that will be spent in slavery. God says this to Abraham way back in Genesis 15, and guess what? It ends up being true. Because, of course, the people of Israel end up living in what land?
Egypt,
right. They end up living in Egypt as first, not as slaves. Actually, at first, life is good in Egypt. They have the favor of the Pharaoh. They're multiplying quickly. But then the Pharaoh dies that knows them and likes them. There's a change in power, and the new Pharaoh looks at this multiplying group of people and views them as a threat. And so he does a couple of things to try and control this group of people. One of them is to put them into slavery. Okay? The other is quite a bit, perhaps more gruesome even. And the people of Israel, the Hebrew people, stay as slaves until there's a baby born who's put in a basket and sent down a river. Anybody remember this baby's name? Moses. Yeah, Moses, right. Now, Moses is sent down the river in a basket, not because his mom and dad don't love him. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. There's an edict in the land that all firstborn, all boys will be killed. And so to try and save their son, they send him down the river. One of the people of Pharaoh's house finds Moses in this basket, essentially adopts him as her own son. And Moses, a Hebrew, grows up in the Egyptian wealth and educational system, probably has the best that the world has to offer in many respects. One day Moses is out walking and he sees a fellow Egyptian beat up a Hebrew person, and Moses becomes enraged by this. He kills the Egyptian, tries to cover it up by burying this guy in the sand. But as we know, both then and now, the truth always has a way of coming out. And Moses is found out, what he's done is discovered. And Pharaoh, in anger, tries to hunt Moses down and kill him. So Moses has to flee into the desert, and he's in the desert. Anybody know how long he's there, how long Moses is in the desert? 40 years, yep. 40 years he's in the desert. Hold on to that number. And it's all really a time of preparation for him, because right around the end of that 40th year, he spots something up on a mountain that's burning but isn't. Yeah, a bush, right? Moses goes and he finds that God is somehow there in the midst of this thing. And God calls him to go to Pharaoh and to tell Pharaoh to release the Hebrew people. And Moses says, no way. And God says, yes way, I will be with you. And Moses says, no way, what will I tell them? Who sent me? And God says, yes way, tell them I sent you. And Moses says, no way, I'm not going to go. What if no one believes me? I'm not a very good speaker. And God says, yes way, I will be with you. And back and forth. Oh, there you go. Yahweh. Yep. Probably. So Moses ends up going to Pharaoh. Pharaoh, I've come on behalf of Yahweh. Release the people of Israel. And Pharaoh says, no way. And Moses says, yes way. And back and forth they go. There are these 10 plagues that are brought upon Egypt, wreak havoc on Egypt. And it's after the 10th one that Pharaoh finally relents and the Hebrew people are allowed to leave. They leave, and immediately they bump up against this big body of water called the Red Sea, and they all die. No, they don't die. What happens? What happens at the Red Sea? They do think they're going to die. In fact, they say, let's just go back to being slaves. It was better there. And God does what? Parts the Red Sea. And through they go, and Pharaoh chases, and Pharaoh's army gets swallowed up by the sea. They get on the other side, and then they make their way for one month, to a mountain that was kind of familiar. It was the mountain where Moses met God in the burning bush, Mount Sinai, and there God gives the people the law. And the law is given to the people so that they would know how to live in such a way that they might be an example to the rest of the world. The rest of the world might look at them and go, you guys are kind of weird, different, in a good way. What's going on? They might be curious and drawn to Israel and therefore drawn to Yahweh. Okay, God gives them the law, and then, oh boy, you know, things don't go great. As we talked about last week, they spend how long in the desert? 40 years. There's another 40 years. How long does Jesus spend in the desert? 40 days. These are all seasons of preparation, right? Jesus, as we've talked about throughout this series, is Israel, he is Israel finally living out its calling, right? He's finally everything Israel was supposed to be. That's Jesus. And it's why you see so much in his life. Jesus mirrors some of the major events of Israel's life because he's pointing to this fact that he's finally fulfilled who Israel was supposed to be. All right, so they're wandering in the desert. Manna and golden calves and all sorts of stuff happens there. Finally, they get to this land and flowing with milk and honey, which sounds pretty delicious. And they decide, you know what? It's not worth it. It's too dangerous. This isn't at the end of the 40 years. This is actually not long into that 40-year period. Too dangerous. So they turn around, and God says, well, you're not ready. You're not going to enter. And so it is then 40 years. And finally, okay, at the end of that long period is where we pick up the story in Joshua chapter 1, verse 1. Zeke, would you go to that slide? This is the story of the transition between Moses and Joshua. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' aide, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now then, you and all these people, get ready to cross the river Jordan into the land I am about to give to them, to the Israelites. I will give you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses. Your territory will extend from the desert to Lebanon, from the great river, the Euphrates, all the Hittite country, to the Mediterranean Sea in the west. No one will be able to stand against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. So be strong and courageous, because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their ancestors to give them. 6. Here we are. Here's the rest of the story. This is up on the screen. verse 20. This is after 7 days of marching around the city. That's what God said to them to do. You're going to take the city by just marching around it one time a day for 6 days. And on the seventh day, you'll walk around seven times. And then you're all going to yell and the priests are going to blow their horns. And this is what happened. When the trumpet sounded, the army shouted. And at the sound of the trumpet, when the men gave a loud shout, the wall collapsed. So everyone charged straight in and they took the city. And that's where we usually end the story. They devoted the city to the Lord and destroyed with the sword every living thing in it, men and women, young and old, cattle, sheep, and donkeys. This is one of a number of passages in Joshua and in Deuteronomy where either Israel acting on their own or because God commanded them to, they completely destroy and annihilate a people. And this is troubling for a lot of Christians, and I think rightly so, because it seems to be dissonant with the image of God that we see certainly in Jesus Christ, let alone most of the Old Testament, actually, where God is slow to anger, quick to love, and in which we see in Jesus, especially on the cross, a God who loves his enemies, doesn't destroy them. In Jesus, we see a God who lays down his life instead of taking the lives of others, who forgives those who beat and puncture his body. And so we have Jesus over here, this image of God, and in other places in the scriptures. And then in Joshua and some other spots, we have these depictions of God that are like this, and we feel very confused by it. We're not sure what to do. One common response that I found for many Christians is that when it comes to Joshua and Deuteronomy, these difficult passages, the response is to just ignore it. Just avoid that part of the Bible. If we could just box that up and keep it over here, we'll keep looking at the rest of the passages, but we're just going to ignore and avoid these difficult things, right? I think that is a very common reaction. And maybe that's an option for some people, but I would like to think that as a church, we've decided to be a community of people that doesn't run from the difficult and complex things of faith, but actually heads right into them and pokes and wonders and asks questions together because we believe that in the wrestling, that's how we grow and are transformed. Amen? I think that's who we have decided to be. And so ignoring or avoiding really isn't an option, let alone the fact that I would bet my house that all of you know someone who has thought about Christianity, wondered if maybe Christianity was something for them to give their lives to, but they've got these, they know enough that they've read or heard about these passages in the Old Testament and they don't know what to do with them. And they say, why would I follow a God like that? You all have people like that in your life. Chances are that some of you, at the very least, are going to be asked by those people, what do you make of that? Hey, you're a Christian. How do you make sense of Joshua? And it would be really great, I think, if we could give some sort of articulate response, even if part of the response goes, I'm not entirely sure what to make of that, but I have wrestled with it. I have thought about it. Here's where I am at the moment, right? Right? I mean, would you want to be asked by someone only to go, I haven't really thought about that, right? We're going to leave that exchange feeling probably pretty awkward and disappointed. So, all kinds of reasons that I think ignoring and avoiding is not the best choice. Another very popular option when it comes to these difficult passages is to think that God must be schizophrenic. Now, no one has ever or rarely uses that word, but come on. Haven't you maybe thought about this? Like maybe the God of the Old Testament or of these passages is just kind of, I don't know, having a bad day or at certain times responds in this way, and then at certain other times responds in this way, or maybe God has changed over. I mean, people who are wrestling with this sometimes come to that conclusion. I'm not sure that's the best choice either. But then what do we do? if we don't avoid it, or if we don't think that maybe God is schizophrenic somehow, how do we make sense of these passages? We're going to wrestle with that this morning. And I think that in large part, if you're going to try and figure this out, it probably comes down to the way in which you understand how the Bible was written. This is the teaching kind of part of this morning. And why we gave you a little piece of paper to write notes on, because this might be worth writing down. If you're someone who hasn't encountered this stuff before, this might be worth just writing down so that you can keep thinking about it at home and you would have some notes to go off of. What we're talking about here is biblical inspiration. This is a theological term for how we understand how the Bible came to be written. Okay? And you can see there's a spectrum here. And on one end of the spectrum might be something called the dictation model or theory. Okay? That when the Bible was written over time, what happened was that the human authors became like dictation machines. God spoke to them or somehow influenced them in a way that they became like human typewriters, so that every word that we have in the Bible was dictated by God and written down by human beings. Now, actually, very few Christians throughout time and even today would hold to something that rigid, but it's kind of the far end of the spectrum, okay? On another end might be what you call a little model called natural intuition. And these things can go by different names, but it's probably the most common. On this end, people who hold to this would say, hey, the Bible is inspired much in the same way that Shakespeare is inspired. That human beings had an intuition about them, about maybe what was true. And so they wrote it down, and the Bible now has become a collection of really, really important and really concentrated kind of ideas and truth. But it's all really come about because human beings have just had this natural intuition about the way the world works. Again, probably not a lot of people who hold to this far extreme of things, but you can see that there's kind of this continuum here from understanding that the Bible came to be because God had a great deal of influence. Right on this end, God has a great deal of influence. Humanity, the authors of the Bible, have a very low level of involvement. They're just dictation machines taking over, and they type out the Bible. They write it down. And then on this end, you know, God would have actually a very low amount of involvement, and human beings would have a very high level, or maybe all, if you get way, way down to the end of the spectrum. And so there's this range. Now, most of the models, surprise, surprise, fall somewhere in here, right? And today in our world, a good chunk of kind of evangelical, conservative evangelical thought would probably land more on this end of the spectrum, somewhere in here, and would say that, okay, human beings were not dictation machines when the Bible was written, but every word was ensured by God. Right? The Bible, in other words, is infallible in every word. Every word is perfectly as it should be. Most people would say, yeah, human beings had a role to play. That's why Matthew and John's Gospels are different. And there's different writing styles and different audiences being written to because the authors were different. Okay. But still, regardless, every word, every single word is ensured by God. It's there intentionally because God wants it to be. And then if you get down here on this end, that begins to lessen. Humanity's ability to influence how the scriptures were written grows a little bit. So there's a quote, I think, Zeke, on the next slide. This is by a guy named Adam Hamilton. He's a pastor, down south somewhere. He wrote a book called Making Sense of the Bible. If all this stuff is new to you, you haven't wrestled with it before, his book is really accessible. It's pretty theologically balanced. It's not on either end of the extreme. And he does a nice job. I think it's worth picking up if this is something that you haven't thought through a whole lot. Making Sense of the Bible. He says this, the Bible was written by human beings whose understanding and experience of God was shaped by their culture, their theological assumptions, and the time in which they lived. So he would argue for a little bit more, somewhere maybe in here, you know, that humanity has an influence on the writing of the Bible, and that the human authors, their limited perspective, the way in which culture influenced them, their own theological assumptions, sometimes influenced what was written. Okay, so there you go. Let's have coffee. But if you're over here, somewhere in this general area, and you believe that every word that's in our Bible was inspired by God and is there purposefully and is perfect as it is, it's inerrant in that sense of the word, then how do you make sense of Joshua 6? Well, there's a few ways that people do this. One is to say, listen, did God tell Israel to kill every person in Jericho and all the other cities in Canaan? Yes. It's in the Bible. And so it's meant to be in the Bible. God said it. So why did God do that? Folks over here would say because the sin of Canaan was so great that God was justly, in a just way, punishing them for their sin. That's one explanation that comes out of this way of making sense of Joshua 6. They were sinful. God was punishing them for their sin and was doing it justly. In other words, they deserved it. Or, some people have said, God told Israel to annihilate everyone because God wanted to remove the temptation for Israel to worship other gods. Jesus, the person who willingly allowed himself to be arrested and humiliated and beaten and crucified, it doesn't resonate for me with the Jesus who says to Peter when he picks up the sword and cuts off the ear of one of the guards that came to arrest Jesus. You remember that story? Which, by the way, Peter has terrible aim. I've always thought that. Don't you? Just cuts the ear off. I mean, the guy's right there. Anyway, you know, Jesus says to Peter, those who live by the sword die by the sword. Don't you know, Peter, that I have an army of angels? I could call them down and wipe this whole thing out. But I don't do that. So that's just me. I'll get to kind of where maybe you should be in a moment. And a little preview. I'm not going to tell you where you should be on this whole thing. But that's how some folks have made sense if they're over here. If people are over here, more believing that humanity's cultural perspectives, their understanding of the world at the time, that can influence and show up in the scriptures, this is how they might make sense of things. Zeke, I think a couple slides ahead or something along that line. If you would click, awesome. So this is that same quote, only a little bit more of it from Hamilton's book. The Bible was written by human beings whose understanding and experience of God was shaped by their culture, their theological assumptions, and the time in which they lived, which, by the way, is exactly what is true of us. Then we might be able to say, in this case, he's talking about in cases like Joshua and Deuteronomy, the biblical authors were representing what they believed about God rather than what God actually inspired them to say. So he's saying, listen, these parts of the Bible may be more a result of the influence of the authors' cultural perspectives and understanding of how the world works. And a lot of people hold to this because they know that at that time in the world, we have archaeological evidence, actually, that at that time in the world, it was very common for people groups to believe that God sent them into war, was with them in war, and commanded them to kill everyone as an act of worship. We have archaeological evidence of other cultures doing this exact very same thing that we see in the Bible. And so some folks say, hey, maybe this is just a result of the fact that these people grew up in this culture. This was how they understood that the world worked and that God worked. And so that comes out in the scriptures. Okay, that's one way of viewing this. Now, here's the deal. You may love that. You may hate it. You may love this. You may hate it. What I know is that very smart, loving, kind followers of Jesus have wrestled with this issue their whole lives, written volumes about it, and come to different conclusions. Which means that if we all come to different conclusions, it's okay. There's enough room here in this church for you to think that to be down here on this end, and for someone else to be down here on this end. There's enough room. This is not a central issue to the gospel. It is important. If you haven't wrestled with this, you should. This is actually really valuable to think through. But if we come and land in different places, it's okay. I can still love you, and you can still love me, right? So lots of difference of opinion. That's like the 10-second whirlwind journey through biblical inspiration. Hopefully some of it is helpful just to give you a sense of how people try and make sense of these difficult passages. Let me end this morning on one thing that I think every Christian can agree on. So we have a lot of diversity here. Let me end on one thing that I think we all can agree on, and that is the supremacy of Jesus. Look at this passage from Hebrews chapter 1, very beginning of that New Testament book. The writer says this, "In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at various times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things and through whom also he made the universe. The Son, Jesus, is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word." All right, so the writer of Hebrews is saying a couple of things that are really important. Number one, in the past, God spoke to us through who? The prophets, okay? And at various times and in various ways. The word there for times can also be translated in pieces or bits or fragments. A lot of biblical scholars look at this and say, you know what, you could actually interpret the last part of verse 1 this way. God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at various times, in partial ways, in bits and pieces. We got a partial picture of who God is, but that's not the way that it is now. Look at verse 3. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. In Jesus, we find out what God is really like. His essence, that's the Greek word there for representation. God's very essence is captured in Jesus. We don't get bits and pieces anymore. We get the full, clear picture of who God is. Now, can you and I gain understanding from other things? Yeah. Can we gain an understanding of God from creation? Yes. From each other when we are at our best? Yes. Can we gain an understanding of God through the prophets, through the things of the Old Testament? Absolutely. But the fullest representation, the one who, pardon the pun here, trumps all others. That's not a pun. What is the reference you're going to make in your mind? Pardon that. You know, the one who, Jesus is above all others when it comes to how we understand who God is. Which means that everything, including passages like Joshua 6, have to be held up and measured against what we see and know from Jesus. Yes? Look at what Jesus says about himself in John 4. Jesus says, "You search the scriptures because you think they give you eternal life, but the scriptures point to me." You're looking back at the Old Testament, he's saying to the Pharisees in this exchange. And you're looking for the full revelation of eternal life there, but I'm actually telling you, it's found in me. I'm the clearest picture of the life that you are meant to have, of who you are meant to be and who God is. And then in Luke 7 and in John 5, if Zeke would be so kind as to throw that up. Is that up there, buddy? Maybe. There it is. So Jesus is talking about John the Baptist. He says, I tell you, among those born of women, there is no one greater than John the Baptist. Take all the prophets, all the kings, Moses, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There's no one greater than John. And then in John 5, Jesus says, my testimony is heavier than John's. It carries more weight than John's. So, right, just kind of follow the progression. You got all the prophets, kings, patriarchs, Moses. John the Baptist is greater than all of them. His testimony is greater. And Jesus says, but my testimony, my life, is even greater than John's. So all that to say, if you want to know who God is, you look at Jesus. And for a long time, a great many Christians have said that we should judge all other words of the Bible against God's definitive word, Jesus Christ. We measure everything against what we see in him. He is our starting point and our ending point. His life and testimony are supreme above all other revelations. We remember that he is the radiance of God's glory, the exact representation of God's character. He is the one, therefore, who breaks bread with sinners, who reaches out to prostitutes and adulterers. He hangs on the cross and prays for his executors. This is what I think it means in the New Testament to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus. All right, when we bump up against something that doesn't make sense, we say, okay, that's very confusing. I'm very anxious about that. I'm troubled by what I'm reading there. I don't get it, but I choose to trust you, Jesus. I believe that my picture of who God is that I see through you is enough, is strong enough to hold me even when I am bumping up against doubt and questions and confusion. So I choose to believe you. I choose to trust you. I choose to turn my heart back towards you. I choose to give you my anxiety. I choose to hand over my questions. It's really what we say when we share this meal. We're saying that we choose to trust Jesus.